You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, December 17th, 2025, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Cara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, everyone.
And we have a special guest, Ian Callanan. Ian, thanks for joining us again.
Hello, everyone. Hey. How are you?
You know they can see you.
You're good, man.
Has become a regular on our year-end wrap-up show. This is it, the last show of 2025.
Oh my gosh. What a year.
What a good year.
Oh my God.
I think we'll have one or two things to say about this year coming up.
How much worse can it get?
don't even.
Wait a couple hours.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, wait.
Gosh.
I would not assume it could
be. I'll break the ice here by letting everyone know that I'm sick with the flu.
And we told them last week.
Okay.
All right.
I just want people to know because like
Jay is still sick with
but also, it hasn't been a week since we recorded. It's been two days.
Yeah. It's been a week in podcast time. It's been 2 days in reality.
In podcast.
That means the week really flew.
It's forever. Okay.
Thanks, Ian.
Now, does anyone remember me being sick last year at this time?
I was sick last Christmas. Were you sick last Christmas or the week before also?
It's right around this time of year. Like the pattern is my daughter goes to school. Apparently, his best friends with whoever the most sick kid is.
Yep.
And then she comes home and infects me, and then I infect my wife.
Yes.
Yeah. That's having kids. They are petri dishes.
Gross.
Is that good for us as parents? Okay. Thank you.
It's not good checking. To be exposed to deadly illnesses all the time.
Oh. Well, my uncle on Facebook said otherwise. So
I watched a TikTok video once. And, you know,
why?
Thank you.
Last year, I had a cold over over Christmas. It wasn't the flu, but it was a cold. Mm. And I got COVID. I can't remember if it was just before or just after, maybe like a month apart. And my cold was like 10 times worse than my COVID.
Wow.
I felt so ill. And when I had COVID, it was like the sniffles for a few days.
Well, did you have the vaccine?
I have been vaccinated 3 cards worth times.
Were you close to anyone else around you who was also suffering a cold with similar symptoms?
It's funny. I couldn't find patient zero for that one. I got magic sick. No, I have a feeling that I caught something when I was at the pharmacy picking up meds. I remember somebody coughing in the aisle and I held my breath as I walked by, but I had that feeling of
that
like,
doesn't work.
That's me. I'm sick. I'm sick right now. I felt myself get sick from that.
I do know the moment. I can pinpoint a moment where I'm like, okay, I have a cold coming. Yeah. This is it. My throat is sore.
Yeah.
But you know how you try to will it away for the first 2 days?
I know. I'm like, ooh, Advil, give me Advil quick.
Yeah, you're like, it's not really. I just slept with my mouth open.
No, I always know when I'm going to get really sick. It sucks. That first little inkling, like, shit, this is it.
It's the tickle. The tickle in your nose.
That tickle.
It's so uncomfortable.
I remember colds.
Jay, how did you know? Because the flu is like a whole other beast. It's so much worse than a cold.
Yeah, it starts with like an internal itch. You know, you get like that. You get that like, oh, what's going on? You know, like and there's always that disdain. But it progressed very quickly. Like I went to bed. I'm like, I feel like something's happening. You know, because my sinuses. Mm-hmm. And then I wake up the next day and I'm like, oh God, this is it hit hard. And the entire day I was suffering from the chills, and that was really horrible.
And it's that malaise. I mean, it's the perfect word for how you feel when you have the flu.
But it's remarkable how your energy is gone.
Mm-hmm.
Like just Zapped. Utterly gone. Like I got up
a
couple of times today.
Steve? What's going on there?
I had to rest from going to the bathroom. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, that's a lot of work sometimes.
He's winded after...
Ian.
This is a good segue because I was going to say, can you think your way out of that?
No.
like being sick? Okay, because I wanted to bring up, I know if this was what you were going to ask me, I wanted to bring up like the failure of the power of positivity, if I may, a little bit. So the last like week ago or so, I attended a funeral of a family
member.
Sorry,
sorry to hear that.
Sad, thank you. I know he had pancreatic cancer and was like very aggressive. He survived a whole year like from the diagnosis.
That's the average life expectancy from diagnosis is 1 year.
Yeah, yeah. So like, now, he was like a little wooey, but like his siblings were all like very like pro-science. So like we did all the things. We went to New Haven, Yale, tried experimental things. You know, it didn't work, obviously.
Yeah.
But, you know, the thing I wanted to bring up is like the power of positivity kind of infected everybody in a way that I found was actually troubling.
Oh.
Because even the week before he died, they were still ordering like medical devices to like get him in and out of bed. They were besides themselves with like, oh, he'll recover. He was the youngest. He was only 60 when he died. You know, like he was the baby of the siblings. He was like a comedian, the glue of the siblings sort of thing, you know. So like they were really shook up about it. But the power of positivity, I feel like, blinded them to see what was coming.
Yeah. That's so common.
With the funeral, we had no plans for him. Like, didn't know what he wanted.
Oh.
We all kind of just winged it.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
didn't really know what the burial should be. Didn't know anything. And so much so that they kind of fell for the idea of, like, we should bring him home so he's comfortable while he recovers.
Yeah.
So much so that he, by the time he got to hospice, it was, like, too late. The nurses weren't prepared. Even one of his siblings was a hospice nurse. And he said it was like the worst thing he'd ever seen. Couldn't drain his fluids, give him medication.
That's really common, even that people go to hospice long after they should have first gone to hospice.
Exactly.
And when I say should, all I really mean by that is for them to have had good quality of life after they've stopped taking life-sustaining treatments or you know, cancer-fighting treatments. Because in hospice, there's so much comfort care available to you. And a lot of people wait so long that some of those things can't really be, you know, taken care of as well as they could have early on. A lot of people have, if they make the decision at the right time, they have time to do things that they want to do and, you know, engage in bucket lists and things like that.
Yeah.
But Kara, how do you break through that wall?
Well, it's like, okay. So I work with the patients mostly, but people on my team work with the families as well. And I have worked with families. It's not uncommon for me when I first see a patient in the cancer center for them not to have an advance directive and for them not to have thought about a lot of these things. So big thing that we do in therapy is go there. We go to the hard place. And when the patient goes to the hard place, sometimes that helps the people around them go to the hard place, but sometimes it doesn't. Mm. So a lot of what we do is work on how we cope with the fact that the bubble of people around the patient aren't thinking realistically about the end. The patient is often the only one who is
I think people feel a lot of pressure to be positive.
Yeah, of course.
To be supportive, I'm going to like focus on the hope and the positive angle and and then that morphs into the magical thinking of the power, as you say, the positive power of positive thinking. Like you can fight, you can, you know, just think positive thoughts and everything will be all right. But that's not a healthy approach to this at all. That then morphs into denial, which I've seen as well. You know, as you know, Kara, for a time I was treating a lot of patients with ALS, and the denial was the worst thing. That was the absolute worst thing.
Especially
that
with ALS,
completely hamstring the management. And the approach is that you have to gently but firmly tell them like it is, make them answer questions. Like you have to decide whether or not you're going to get intubated when the time comes, et cetera, et cetera. You just force that, and then you give them time too. But you have to just start early. You know, you don't push early, and you give them months, you know, to come to terms with what's happening. But to the extent that patients go into this positive thinking denial, they absolutely harm themselves in so many ways. It is absolutely harmful. I agree.
Is this just like a cultural thing?
It is. I think it can be very cultural. It's hard too when you're working with patients where culturally there are some pretty strong rules around what you can and can't talk about.
Because
obviously I work in and you did too, Steve, like a large hospital in a large city, right? Which is a huge melting pot. It's very multicultural. But a few things that I would say, Ian, one of the things that I do, it doesn't solve the problem, but it's important to me, is I don't use euphemisms And right. Steve, I know we've talked about this too. I say the word death and dying.
Yeah.
I don't talk about passing or when you go or when you, I'm like very clear in my language, and I start to normalize that language early. And, but I also measure the patient's reaction to that and work with them on their death anxiety. The other thing though, is that there's a fine line between hope and, as you mentioned, denial. And it's not bad to have hope so long as, and I use this phrase all the time, so long as we understand that hope is a moving target. What we hope for changes based on the progression of our illness. Right. When we can't move with the target and we're maintaining hope that we had upon diagnosis, when we still have treatments available to us that have the potential to be life extending. But now let's say we've exhausted all our resources. We've already gone through all the clinical trials and our oncologist is saying there is nothing left for treatment and it's time to start talking about your end of life options. If you're still hoping that you're going to get better, that's problematic.
So the other layer here that has a massive influence on how you're able to navigate this whole situation is the amount of trust that the patient and their family has in the system. And this is where the really terrible effects of conspiracy thinking and all of the anti sort of medicine alternative crap and wellness industry propaganda is so harmful, because when there's a lack of trust and you're telling them, trust me, you have a year to live, you need to prepare for it, they're like, fuck you, I'm going to do other things, I don't trust what you're telling me. And then they go out, they spend all their money, they waste their time. Mm-hmm. They don't make important decisions that they have to make. It's really harmful.
And it's hard. It's hard to know what anybody, even the strongest skeptic, it's hard to know that what they would do when they realize that there are no good options.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, we'll all kind of sometimes try things that are a little extreme if we have the disposable income to do it, or if we're, you know, if even though it's a long shot, we don't see any downside, we may do things that we wouldn't think we would do when we're well.
Yeah.
I think one of the biggest concerns that I see, and Steve, I'm curious about your take on this, and Ian, I'm wondering how much insight you have into this. I struggle when I see patients working with providers where the providers have not managed their own death anxiety. And so the providers aren't being very clear. They're not giving true prognostication. They're sort of kicking things down the line. Oh, well, we'll worry about that when that's an issue. Right now, I want you to focus on getting well. And I see this, you know, not a lot, but I see it enough that I find it really difficult to deal with.
You know, I'd say I hate to start the show this way, but this is an appropriate discussion for 2025, don't you think?
It is. It's
absolutely.
Yeah, sorry about that.
By comparison, it's happy here.
Ian, the question I was going to ask you is when is the first episode of Political Reality?
Oh my God. Ooh, God. Now you're really putting the screws to me. So we just finished actually a little intro video that we're going to be editing it up, but we have like 7 episodes in the can. They just need a little refinement, I think. And I think we're going to post it both by the end of the year, the first of the year, maybe January.
We haven't actually
decided on that. That's what I thought too. It's like, hey, 2026, we're fixing.
Yeah, at this point, you might as well just say like first week of January, we'll post.
Yeah, whatever. We still haven't figured out the exact day, but yeah, let's do first of the year.
We have to make it happen.
We'll commit to it. We'll make it so.
Okay. People are starting to doubt that it exists.
No, it exists. I keep telling them, and they're like, editing is so easy. You edit a podcast.
Don't lose hope, people.
I will say, this is video, and video is 10 times harder than audio. Yeah.
It is a lot more.
If we were closer to April 1st, I don't think anyone would believe you.
That's true.
But you know what happened January 1st, 1996, 30 years ago?
Oh, God, what? What's that?
The official launch of the Connecticut Skeptical Society.
Oh!
30 years.
I thought you were going to say something that felt like 5 years ago.
A couple of young kids.
Yeah.
Just hoping to change the world.
That's right. Yeah, it was like, hey, let's, hey kids, let's get together and put on a,
put on a show.
Put on a show, kind of. Yeah, that's, it all started that way. Just.
All right, so the first segment we usually do in this year-end review is the best and worst of 2025. And we could start with the best and worst of the SGU. Is there anything that you guys remember from the past year that sticks out?
Should we just go to Nauticon right now?
Nauticon was great.
Nauticon
was pretty good.
So epic. I mean,
we put the first half of our year, so much effort went into that. I mean, Jay, and you can speak more to that than anyone.
Oh my God,
any
if
of us
can actually
he can,
speak.
He has.
Speak.
Yeah, what Jay would say right now is
it's an incredible amount of work, but you know, you just do a little bit every day, and you know, I get through it, no problem. It's largely me, and then you know, Ian is handling the technical side, but we do work a lot together throughout that process. But
it's,
I mean,
a good committee. It's
so
committee.
Worth it. We had so much fun. Like, people really, you know, that was our highlight, I think.
Yeah,
this year was definitely that conference. I mean, it felt fantastic, and I really thought everyone had a great time.
We had high expectations going into it, and I think we achieved those expectations. At least
absolutely.
That was the feedback we received.
The first one, the first one was so perfect. I'm like, how are we going to beat that? And like, well, we did. It was,
and so much of it. I mean, not to undermine all of the incredible hard work, and like, I mean, it was phenomenal having all of these great guests there. Who was there with us like through the whole thing? It was
Adam.
George, Adam,
Brian, and Andrea
and Brian. Yeah,
year.
And they were phenomenal. But it's we have like literally the best listeners, the best fans.
Right?
The group of people that was there with us was just incredible. They made the weekend.
Yeah, of course.
Oh, absolutely. Yes,
totally.
The vibe was incredible.
Yeah, it would have been boring without him.
We would have made it work.
we would have had fun, but it wouldn't have been the same.
Definitely not.
We got some emails. Listener Victor wrote from episode 1061. Bob says, talking about the Neo robot, Bob said it really needed help for most anything it did. It needed help. And Kara responds, oh, great. So it's like having a man in your house. So wonderful. You want to go do it? Okay, let me help you the whole time.
That was great.
A little sexist, though, Kara. It was a little sexist. But
close enough, kernel of truth.
That was, it was describing reality.
Hey, I'm pretty independent for my house chores.
That's good to know. But I can point to the vast majority
modern man.
Of the literature showing that women do, like, by
you
got to
quote statistics.
Not just the majority, but like a ridiculous amount, like a major majority of the domestic labor.
Yeah, but that's an average, you know, which doesn't tell you about everybody.
Well, how do you guys do it? Do you have discrete tasks, and your significant other also has these discrete tasks, and that's kind of how, or do you kind of swap them and trade them here and there, or what?
It's
how does
both.
It work?
Our household has that, but we also do some things together.
Yeah.
For each task, it has its own percentage. You know, like Jocelyn does 80% of the laundry, you know, but cooking is like 50-50. Mm-hmm. She hates shopping, so I do almost all the shopping.
Wow, that's so different than me and Liz. Yeah. Wow.
Well,
it's just chore by chore, you know.
And so much of it, Steve, like when I make snide comments like that, and I'm, of course, I'm being funny, but I'm also trying to hold up a mirror to reality. It's less about what people do, and it's more about the kind of undercurrent of, A, that the tasks that men tend to do in the home tend to be very visible, and the tasks that women tend to be very invisible. They're the ongoing, it's never finished work, whereas men tend to do more discrete tasks where everybody can like go, oh, look, you did the thing, congratulations, or thank you.
I hung that painting. Look
exactly.
At that.
I mowed the lawn. I, you know. And then the other thing is that very often we're not actually talking about the labor itself, but the cognitive labor that goes into it. And so I'm not saying you're the example, but very often a man will say, I go out and I do all the grocery shopping. And it's like, yeah, but she makes the list. She tells you what you need to get. You call and you're like, what brand do we use? I don't know anything. And she has to do all
of the
mental work.
Where the hell
work.
Is that item on the shelves?
And that's a very common issue, even in liberal, progressive, relationships with high levels of parity. When dug underneath the surface, most of the research shows that women are still doing the majority of the cognitive labor.
Yeah.
Which is a huge bummer. We got to fix it.
Victor also wrote, favorite quote of the year was from me. Extraordinary claims don't require extraordinary evidence. They require appropriate evidence.
Mm-hmm.
Remember saying that?
Wow.
And the funniest thing, he said it's a recurring joke that if the SGU ever misses a week, something catastrophic must have happened. Which we said, I guess, more than once.
That is...
We've never missed a week,
that,
right?
That tracks.
We haven't. That's the whole point.
Oh, I see. I get it. I get it.
Right.
We got a lot. Can I say, I know I don't even know what order we're supposed to be doing this.
This is
in,
just best of SGU stuff.
Best stuff. Okay. We got a lot of emails, and I have to agree, and I also agree with the reasoning. It's probably the recency bias.
Oh, yeah.
But that just Battle of it. Hastings episode.
Oh, it was a funny episode.
Recency bias, yeah.
Really funny episode. And I think
good.
That you also left in a lot more banter than usual in that episode.
Because it was funny.
Exactly.
Right.
But people loved it. Like, we got
after
a lot
20
of
years,
feedback.
Steve has learned what's
on. Although a couple of people did felt that you guys were a little pushed back a little bit too hard on my love of history and the Battle of Hastings. Almost dancing around almost being a little anti-intellectual. I'm not saying you are.
What?
A couple of people. They have a point.
Steve left it in to get sympathy.
I know, it was all for humor. It was all for humorous effect. But we do have to understand our audience and the vibe of the show, and you know, saying that, oh, you're a nerd because you like this intellectual discipline is
no, nobody thinks
not at all
that it's bad that you are really into it.
I know. Well, Jay sorted it, but yeah, I know.
Jay was kind of being funny about that.
But yeah, but that's just Jay was just Jay leaning into it and being funny.
Yeah, I mean,
we just think it's bananas that you expected us to be as into it as you are.
Well,
that's
you know,
the difference.
It's appropriate.
Hastings itself.
No, I mean, and I specifically said I'm not a history buff, and that's fine. Who the hell are any of us to put down someone's niche geekdom? I mean, that would be something it's ridiculous.
Oh, quite the opposite.
Something that we would never really do.
Mm, quite the opposite.
You know,
actually.
So yeah, we were definitely leaning into it, and I am proud to say I knew what Steve was talking about. I mean, I read that book. I mentioned it, and it was an awesome book, and I learned a lot, and it was pivotal.
Proud of you.
I am kind of a history buff, but I, you know, the areas where I tend to focus, the documentaries that I tend to watch, they're just not that. I'm not a big
war.
Yeah, they're not battles.
But this was not just Vikings. It wasn't about the fight. It was about the massive cultural change that resulted from it.
We don't have to get back into that.
No,
that's true. Because,
we covered that shit.
History needs more vampires, I think. If there was a vampire in there, I'd be really into
it. I have a favorite. It's so funny because it's like we think about favorite news stories of the year, and often we'll talk about, oh, this was my favorite like science news that we learned. But I was thinking this year about, well, what's my favorite topic that I covered? Like, what did I learn the most from digging?
I do that every year. That's what
do
I do
you?
Every year.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. It's like, this is the one that I covered that I love the most.
Okay, yeah.
If it was a dramatically like best of the year news item, I'm grabbing that, man. It's just like, of course I would grab that, something so that's worthy of that list. So yeah, I invariably, although this year I'm not, ironically, I'm not necessarily picking something that I talked about because I think it's just something that needs to be at least mentioned on the show. So
I think they're just two different things. Like some of my favorite science news, which we'll get to, were like huge discoveries and like amazing things that happened mostly in medicine. But my favorite news item that I did was I had to dig for it, but it was episode 1058, which I think was in October. I covered this study where the researchers described a construct that they called symbolic strength.
And
really deep into like why people find pride in like denying reality and why they seem so entrenched and how hard it is to quote change their minds, because not only do they not want their minds changed, they feel special having the anti viewpoint. And
they
it's
have
just
a golden
is it just the anti viewpoint or is it like yeah, is it like special knowledge?
It's weird the what it's not, and it's not even like the whole conspiracy thing where like we're the ones who know and you don't really know, but it's like, oh, the mainstream, they are whatever they would call them, liberal cucks.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's like, they're like, but we have the, you know, information, even if it flies in the face of evidence.
But does it require that we, that like group think consolidation or like camaraderie that they have it, or can they exhibit it on their own individually?
I like, do think it requires the camaraderie, because these aren't just like made up viewpoints. They're echo chamber viewpoints.
Yeah. Flat earth kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
It becomes part of the group identity.
Exactly.
I have a favorite news item from this past year.
Mm-hmm.
If you guys remember, I talked about lab grown teeth.
Yeah. Oh, you did. Yes.
Love that.
You know, and if you guys remember, the this wasn't like a minor achievement, this last level that they got to, like they're legit testing it, you know? Like this could be a thing. It could really happen. So I think that's encouraging.
Promising. That was fun, yeah.
Cuz you know, not only is dentistry crazy expensive, but it could be horribly painful, and it's really sad to, you know, lots of people have to lose their teeth and they have to get implants and all that stuff. Like if this works out, you know, could avoid all of that.
Wouldn't it still be an implant? Or I assume you're not growing it back in your skull. I think you assume you're growing it externally and then putting it back.
No, they're planting the butt in your jaw and then growing.
Yeah. Oh, they are planting the butt. Oh, okay. Neat. That part. Oh, that's neat.
I have a couple things from the interwebs, from our listeners talking online. A lot of people liked Bob's mega rant about quantum crystals. You remember that one, Bob?
What? No.
It was a pseudoscience item, and you got so outraged at the pseudoscience that you had this monologue rant afterwards that people loved.
Just a classic quantum pseudoscience crap. Yeah, I hate that shit.
You probably said grind my gears at some point during that.
And you guys have a favorite guest?
Ooh.
I remember we had Dr. Nick Tiller, the exercise scientist. Mm-hmm. That was a fun interview. I like that one. That
Professor
one was memorable.
Dave came on the show. Yep.
Professor
I think
Dave.
One of my favorite interviews, I mean, anytime we have the chance to talk to Marsh, I love those interviews.
Oh, yeah. I hadn't seen, had we not seen him since QED in 2018? Maybe.
In person?
Perhaps the last time he was on an SGU episode.
Wow, really? And what a great thing that he and Cecil, that they're doing this podcast where they dig into Joe Rogan episodes.
Oh, really? That's like the focus?
Yeah, it's the No Rogan podcast.
The No Rogan.
I love it.
With a K.
The No Rogan. Nice.
Mm-hmm. Oh, gosh. Mm-hmm. I hope it's also 3 hours because you need that per episode, because you need that much time to undo what he's doing.
I like the interview with Kyle Johnson, the philosopher. I think it was like the perfect level of wonkiness for the show. You know what I mean? Getting it, like, let's do a deep dive on logic and like really suss it out. Cause we obviously it's something that comes up a lot on the show. So it was great to talk to a philosopher, you know, an actual expert, and like really dial it in tight, you know,
Lot. Yep. Yep.
Well, we did mention, most interesting or best, whatever science news item. I was going to talk about the whole Oz Olo color thing, which I mentioned only because I talked about it. We're at the Nauticon show on stage, and I, for some reason, this was just so extra fascinating, be how color perception and how the retina works and all that. I took a few onion layers deeper than I typically delved, and it was just so fascinating. That one really comes to mind, but I think we have to mention, it's kind of obvious. It's not the best, it's not the most interesting science of the year, but it's the most impactful, and it's pretty obvious. You know, the gutting of science research in the United States this year has been unprecedented. Thousands of researchers, you know, withholding federal research funding, dismantling, you know, climate research. It's been devastating, and we'll feel the impact for generations. This is like the biggest science news item of this year. It's like what could impact, what can compare to this in terms of just sheer impact of science in this country? It's just like, it's ridiculous. States, it's just certainly. Like beyond the pale. It's just like, how is this our reality?
Another Bob rant. All right.
Come on, man. That's worthy. Jesus.
And not just defunding science research, but defunding public health programs like AMFAR, like these different, or USAID.
Yes.
Like these programs that, I mean, we know for a fact, like there's a body count. Like there's
And I know, have you read some of the estimates of the numbers?
They're bananas.
Let's see. I read one that was 124. Now these are models, right? Of likely deaths and, you know, excess deaths because of this slash USAID, 124,000 adults, over a quarter million children, 88 deaths per hour. That's the result of what's been done to USAID. And those are the estimates. And even if it's off, I'm sure it's not perfectly accurate, right? But it doesn't matter. Even if it's just somewhat correct, it's devastating. And what the hell?
There's a study.
Oh my God, that's the body count.
Yeah, there's a study out of UCLA that was done by their Fielding School of Public Health this July that said more than 14 million preventable deaths would occur by 2030 if USAID defunding continues, including more than 4 million children under the age of 5.
Yeah, but the savings, though, you know?
Yeah, the savings for their bank accounts tomorrow, but the savings for the globe or even the American government in the long term are not savings.
It was not, you know, but even if you take it as a savings rather than the investment that it is, it was less than what Trump just decided to hand to Argentina.
Yeah, right?
There you go. It's more than what was allegedly, quote-unquote, saved by gutting USAID. That was just madness. There's also, I mean, if we're talking about, crap that happened this year, you know, gutting of support for research, scientific research in the United States is terrible. And I could tell you that the rest of the world is like, come here, you know?
Yeah.
And
they are poaching. Talk about a brain drain. They are poaching all of our talent now because they're not, even if you're here on a visa and you're completely legitimate, you are afraid, you know, that you're just going to be suddenly deported because somebody doesn't like the color of your skin or something, or the country that you came from. So
yeah, it's twofold, Steve. It's like not only are people losing their NIH grants and losing their funding that keeps their labs afloat, people that are either naturalized or natural born citizens, but then you have individuals who, as you mentioned, are all different levels of immigration status who don't feel safe, and many of whom have already been asked to leave. So it's a brain drain, not just of American scientists, but scientists who have become American scientists or who are practicing in America.
Yeah.
Even natural born citizens are like, well, I can't keep my lab open. So this other country that might be offering more funding seems like an interesting place to go. It's like double loss.
And they're like cutting funding for clinical trials or for research that is where they're collaborating with a non-US laboratory or scientist.
Which is legitimate thing.
I know. I mean, within academia, collaborating with people outside of your institution is considered the best. Like that is it's what you're supposed to be striving for, is that kind of collaboration. And now they're punishing people for that. Nope, only work with other Americans. It is insane. It is absolute
horrible
anti-scientific madness. It's crazy.
Lysenkoism. And
it's going to, it is Lysenkoism, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And it's going to hurt us for at least a generation, if not more. We may never get back to where we would have been if they did not do this.
Yeah.
This is like a permanent hit to the U.S.
Yeah,
and to the world.
And it makes me nervous. Yeah. Like, I was looking into the best science news, like the stuff that I was the most excited about this year. And they were, I mean, hands down, gene therapy for Huntington's disease, T-cell acute lymphoblastic leukemia. There's the new CAR T-cell therapy. The first CRISPR that was individually tailored. It was like designer
for the
CRISPR
baby.
for the baby. With a CPS1. And I worry that those stories, that is the confluence, the amalgamation, like the end result of previous year, like a lot of hard work and previous study. How many years are we going to be able to say, look at all this cool stuff that happened, at least in the U.S. this year?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we're going to have years like that.
Maybe a while.
Yeah.
Well, let's shift into best science news of the year. Okay. I agree that the genetic stuff is just incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks to, you know, continue. I think we're just getting started.
Yeah, maybe not we, but the world. The world is just getting started.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But and along those lines, you kind of touched on this. Immunotherapy for cancer also is just taking off.
Mm-hmm.
It is that, you know, there's continued to be advances and breakthroughs this year for that. Also, a couple other things I noted. There's been a number of significant breakthroughs in quantum computing, you know, authoring my assessment of how likely and how soon we may have actual practical quantum computers. I think they got a lot closer this year, more than any other single year that I could remember.
Yeah, it seemed like definitely a multiple incremental, you know, leaps.
And there was a big year for life in the solar system.
Oh, right.
Oh, yes, it was. Yeah. Sure was.
We haven't found the Holy Grail yet. We haven't found actual life in the solar system, but in terms of biosignatures. So we talked very recently, you know, about finding all the makings of RNA on the asteroid Bennu. And the most tantalizing signs of ancient life on Mars that we have yet discovered.
The carbon chain, yes.
Yeah, the large carbon chains, yep.
Yeah, we're peeling that back to the point where, boy, it's just incredible what we've been able to figure out. Plus, we haven't even gotten the samples back from Mars yet.
Yeah.
Which we're still hopefully working on. And I think there was, a glitch in the system, right, Jay? Or there was talk of shelving that, but I think it's back on schedule, if I recall.
I haven't checked recently. But I think the last we heard that it was back, right?
Yes, that was my understanding. And that's going to be so significant. And again, the thing about these particular samples, yes, that we've seen evidence of these things that have on objects that have fallen to Earth, but we're collecting them out in their natural habitat right now and without that contamination, potential for contamination. So it becomes more affirming than anything else that we've been able to study and understand. I'd like to mention, it's not strictly science, but it was certainly significant and it happened almost a year ago. So it was early in the year, you know, and again, the recency bias takes over at a certain point. But the LA fires was a massive, massive story.
That did have
certainly elements of science to it, but also a lot of different things. Kara, it was close to home to you.
Oh, yeah.
Having to deal with that on, you know, a day-to-day basis. It lasted for about 3 or 4 weeks, all of January practically.
Oh, yeah. And we couldn't breathe the air. I mean, it was even those of us who were outside of the evac zones. I was like in the, you know, have your go bag ready area, but I never had to actually evac. Oh, it was horrific. Like I have two pretty fancy like Dyson air filters in my house. You know, those like standalone fans that have the HEPA filters. And
HEPA.
Within a week, I had changed them within the past month or two, and you're supposed to change them maybe once a year, I think. Within the week, they were clogged and not functional anymore.
Whoa.
Like it was bananas. The intake filters in my HVAC were black and thick, like inside my home. And I have a pretty new home that's pretty well sealed. Yeah, I think the air quality was like in the 300s, maybe.
300.
It was something just horrific. Don't quote me on that. I have screenshots of it. But
certainly wasn't just grass and trees and things that burned. There were 18,000 structures
homes
that went up.
So in
those in the particles there that they're being breathed in, there's plastic, there's all kinds of things that is in that air that is hurting, damaging
vintage
people.
Building materials, you know, there's like all, there's
a little asbestos.
There's everything went up into the air. From a personal perspective, you know, I know lots of people who lost their homes because I was close to the Altadena fire, not the fire.
The Palisades fire.
In Palisades. But because I was finishing my fellowship at the time at this like large cancer center, I saw patients from all over and I had patients who lost everything, you know. So not only were they
just
dealing
awful
with their cancer, that's why they were seeing me, but they lost everything.
Ugh.
Yeah. Like it's, I mean, when an entire city goes up in flames like that, like I remember a teenager that I was speaking with and they said the school I went to for elementary, middle, high school, the, you know, grocery store I shopped at, the library I went to, my friend's house, my other friend's house, the place I went to summer camp, they don't exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Just like her entire childhood was wiped off the face of the map.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just, it's pretty hard to fathom.
Yeah.
And that's somebody who survived and is, you know, going to be able to rebuild. There are people who didn't survive.
Now, can we definitively say it wasn't because somebody didn't turn the water on, so to speak?
Well, yes, we can, because we know that the original or the very, very beginning of the fire, folks or an individual is charged for that, right?
Yes.
For intentionally setting the fire.
Yeah, yeah. They have
fireworks?
That's right.
I can't
remember. No. He apparently, oh gosh, it's still playing out, but the evidence against him is that he's deliberately set the fire, but he has shown through his social media posts and other things a fixation with fires. And so I don't know what that is, if there's a mental illness of some sort that accounts for something like that. I wouldn't know how to classify it. I don't want to call him an arsonist per se, right? Because, you know, but definitely it was one person who, with a lighter, started a little fire and it got out of control. Now, they contained it a few days later. But then the winds picked up. There go the Santa Anas, and you lose total control at that point, and it turned into the devastation that it did.
And now I'm seeing here 12 deaths, nearly 7,000 structures, and $150 billion in damages just from the Palisades fire.
That was just the
Palisades. And remember, we had the two huge fires and lots of small fires around them.
31 direct fatalities from all the fires. There were a total of 14 individual fires as a result of this. But they're also saying it's hard to measure the long-term mortality rate of this because of the breathing issues sickness, that everybody is having. You know, it was kind of like, in a sense, 9/11, where people were dying years later from the from having been exposed to that atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you think this will change how we build houses in America? I mean, especially given that this seems to recur over and over, or is that a lost cause? Are we just doomed to keep building out of wood?
It's both, right? I think that in California, we've known about fire risks, and we've also known about earthquake risks, and we do what we can to mitigate, but there's only so much you can engineer your way out of these things. But definitely, I think it'll change the way that we build from a civic perspective, like the infrastructure around the homes.
I hope so. Yeah, and other fire mitigation efforts.
Exactly.
They have to bury all those electrical transmission lines. Mm-hmm.
And we do have to be careful about how the pressure that's put on the water system, and are we trying to tap into water that's not meant to fight, you know, a blazing forest fire with water that's meant to fight, you know, a small structure fire.
All right. Should we go on to Skeptical Hero and Skeptical Jackass of the Year?
Do we start with Jackass so we get all the...
you want to do that first?
You want to do that?
Here's my thing. Yeah. Everything keeps getting really dark. So if we get the dark stuff out of the way, maybe we can end on a higher note.
The end will be happy.
It doesn't matter. We could do Jackass first. Who did you have in mind, Kara?
Yeah, who?
Well, for me, I mean, it's hard because who did we... Did we ultimately choose RFK Jr. last year?
You can pick him again.
So. Well, you're right. The administration really didn't start until this year.
Yeah, so for me it
officially
was,
became RFK this year.
It was RFK and his band of merry science deniers. I mean, it's not just him, right?
Everything he dragged in with him.
Yeah, and I think some of them he dragged in, and some of them just also were there because Trump put them in place. Like, we've got to remember that RFK is the Secretary of Health and Human Services, but we've got Dr. How do you say his last name? Bhattacharya? Jay Bhattacharya, who's the director of NIH. Yeah. We've got Jim O'Neill, who's the deputy secretary of HHS and the acting director of the CDC. We've got Martin Makary, who's the commissioner of the FDA. We've got Mehmet Oz, who is the administrator for, you know, Medicare. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. Like, these are all science deniers to some extent in these very important positions.
Yeah, and Trump is basically MIA. I mean, he's not doing anything. He just let RFK handle everything.
Yeah.
You know, he's really just deferring to him. And, yeah, I mean, for me, it begins and ends with RFK Jr., right? Yeah, so all the people that come along with it as well. But he is anti-science, pseudoscience, conspiracy mongering personified. Mm-hmm. He is the poster child for all of the harm that can be done when you give actual power to these crazy nut job science deniers. And
it's unprecedented.
The power is enormous.
It's just mind blowing, the harm. Again, we talk about like how many people are going to die due to the reckless, you know, cutting of USAID. You know, RFK already has a body count attached to his nonsense.
True.
The only question is how many zeros is he going to add to that, you know, over his tenure. And a lot of that, Mark Crislip just wrote about this on Science-Based Medicine, the fact that, you know what the pandemic preparedness plan is? To do nothing. to do absolutely nothing.
Well, you know,
if we have a pandemic in the next 3 years, we're effed. It's going to be bad.
Why? The last one was a hoax anyway, right?
We're just going to make people healthy, and that they'll be able to fight off the infection. That's basically their plan, which is basically saying we're going to do nothing.
And what really sucks is that even after the horrific results of that plan would be like, well, it would have been worse if we did it your way. It's like, well, Jesus.
It doesn't even make sense from a long-term political expediency perspective, because who's going to die?
Yeah.
It's going to be the older people who voted for these folks. It's going to be the unvaccinated people who voted for these folks. It's going to be a lot of people who are the most vulnerable among us. And it's
I don't think it's going to change the political calculus, but I mean,
well, a huge pandemic would, but I mean, it's just
it'd have to be pretty big. I mean, for COVID, COVID death rates were a lot higher in red states than blue states, in states that were not doing the things, you know, that that would be science-based.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Imagine if COVID happened again, but this was the administration and we had
it was even 10 times worse.
In place.
Yeah. Ladapo is basically the RFK for Florida. You know what I mean? So it's a smaller scope, but basically the same thing. So, I mean, no one can come close to the havoc that RFK is wreaking. But, you know, it's not fair to all the other pseudoscientists out there. So we have to have some runners up, in my opinion.
Yeah,
can't let RFK Jr. overshadow all the other cranks and charlatans that deserve to be mentioned.
We need a top 10 list of the cranks, honestly.
Top 100 list.
Sorry.
I mean, I have a couple of people. Does anybody want to throw something out? Evan, come on.
You want the Avi Loeb?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Oh, my gosh. Why does every article I come across have him as part of the article? Why can't I have an Atlas, right? What is it? 3L Atlas?
3I
Atlas article that does not mention Avi Loeb. Please, someone out there in media, stop referencing this person. I get you have to have clicks and things, but my gosh. It's as if this person is the expert, the only expert on it, and he's nothing of the sort, frankly. All he does is promote his own interpretation of what's going on. I can't find any other reputable scientists that agree with anything. It's all the UFO and UAP community that backs him up. I mean, this guy is the UFO UAP crank of now.
He really has become a crank.
Objects. Yeah, he's become the poster child for all of this. So, I mean, I know we've mentioned him in the past, and I think he's been on this list in the past, but he keeps earning it. I mean, he keeps coming back, and media plays right into his hands, unfortunately. Just today I was reading another one about, it's approaching Earth, and it's accelerating at a rate that can only be, you know, unnatural propulsion. Bull! Mm-hmm. According to one scientist, N equals one. That's it.
NASA recently gave a briefing updating because, you know, the comet is coming to its closest approach to Earth.
It's glowing in X-rays, isn't it?
Yeah. It's doing all the stuff that comets do when it gets closer to the sun. So they began their briefing by saying, this object is a comet. It looks and behaves like a comet.
Good.
And all evidence points to it being a comet. And they specifically called out Avi Loeb.
Really? Good for them.
Yes. I know.
Oh, that's good.
For his posted a non-peer-reviewed preprint. Mm-hmm. And
that's wonderful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They shut that down fast. No, it is a freaking comet. It's, you know what I mean? Yeah. This has been, you know, there's been a massive mission to observe it from everything we have looking at. So anything that we could get eyes on. You know, 3I Atlas has been looking at it. You know, we have so much data, and the more data that comes in, the more obvious it is that this thing is a comet. Now, it's an unusual comet because, of course,
it's
the first interstellar comet. So, why would we think it would be identical to a typical, comet from our own solar system? But you know, whatever, nothing that is anomalous. Just like, oh, that's interesting. A little bit more nickel, okay, or you know, more carbon dioxide than a typical Earth,
right?
You know, solar comet, whatever. Nothing like, oh my God, this has got to be an alien spacecraft.
I have another skeptical jackass I'd like to throw out there. It's more of a category, but I do have a couple of names that fit this category.
Ooh.
And that's TikTok. And I don't know if anyone else has anyone or anything having to do with TikTok on their skeptical jackass. But this platform is just pure poison. I'm sorry. I know there's good and I know there's good stuff on there.
There's good science communicators on there.
And I have it on my skeptical heroes list. I have a list of some people who are doing some very good social media in science. So it is not just a blanket statement. But these people, for example, you have these three people. Nara Smith, right?
Go ahead. Explain it.
Promoting the consumption of raw milk while pregnant.
All right, for that's I thought you were just going to be like, because she is like a little quirky and trad wifey, and like she does some goofy stuff with her husband, and I think they're vampires. Fair. Yeah, she does do some gooey nonsense. Yeah, that's
how about Paul Saladino? You know, have you heard that name?
Oh my god,
the all meat carnivore diet.
Carnivore. Yeah.
Oh, I think I watched a documentary about that guy.
Vegetables are poison, Evan.
That's what
if you watch RFK or anybody in Congress, he is he's walking around with them usually, especially RFK. He's like always there.
Wow.
And I want to mention this because it's funny. The Liver King, right?
We've oh no, that's guy. The documentary I watched. Brian yeah, there's a whole thing on the Liver King.
Yep. If you focus on eating large amounts of raw organ meats, then you're gonna have superpowers. you'll live longer than anyone in your family ever has.
Unfortunately, I think he needs therapy. Like he's not just a crank fully.
Well, you could say that about any of these people.
Lost the plot.
There's somewhere between needing therapy and being.
I mean, so many viewers, so many. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, that too. Sure. But just the amount of clicks these people get is obscene. I have no business getting.
Yeah, as you know, Evan, I'm on TikTok.
Well, yes, and this is why I qualified it.
Follow at
Ian, helps us produce our TikTok videos. And there is a couple of dominant narratives on TikTok that I find myself addressing over and over again, just in different guises. One of them is, this guy who invented a thing was killed, died, therefore he was killed to hide his discovery kind of thing.
Diesel.
We talked about
that. We were just talking about
Diesel.
That's
where that was from TikTok. The other one is that anybody in the healthcare industry wants you to die, wants you to be unhealthy. Everything they tell you is a lie.
Everything
you've ever heard
cancer.
Is a lie. Mm-hmm. And also that history didn't happen. The other thing is whatever. You can't prove anything in history, and therefore, Helen Keller didn't exist, and this building was that nobody built this building. The history denial is. Sarah, I'm not exaggerating in the slightest. Right. I'm barely giving you.
Were you there, Steve? Were you there?
That's so bad.
The buildings didn't. Right. Could not have been built.
There was a huge mud flood around the world 100 years ago. 100 years ago, you think we would have... They're not talking about thousands of years ago. They're talking about 50 years ago, 100 years ago.
Well, they weren't born yet.
I know. It's ridiculous.
There weren't cell phones then, Steve. Nobody captured it.
Can't prove it unless it was on TikTok.
It's a lot about that... molasses spill that killed a bunch of people in Boston. Maybe.
Yeah, that was real.
That's what they think. That was
real. I remember that.
The memory hole is just profound.
Oh, gosh.
It's just sad. And then there's a lot of NASA hate on TikTok.
Oof.
Yeah.
Yeah, that NASA's is a weird one.
Liars.
I mean, part of it is I don't know if I'm influencing it because I also kind of source a lot of the videos, so I actively go seek out the crazy
stuff.
It does get a lot of likes, and who knows if they're bots, but it is seemingly pervasive.
Mm-hmm.
So it is weird. I think all the platforms, unfortunately, have devolved. I mean, X is notoriously run by, somebody who's not necessarily a straight shooter in many ways. Instagram, Facebook, all of those things are, I don't know, social media maybe we shouldn't have started to begin with. Can we go back? There was an era where
but there's also more and more evidence to show how just exceedingly damaging it is to young people's mental health.
Sure, but what do you do? Because obviously we've heard in the news, and maybe it's a little political, but Australia is banning it for under 16 age,
and
16.
Under, right?
However, if you grew up, Kara and I grew up long ago, we grew up in the world where there wasn't the internet, and then there was the internet, right? And I found ways around my parents putting, you know, like an abstinence policy out there. Like, I found other ways to get on the internet. Is this going to do anything, you think?
I do personally because I don't think it's the same as abstinence. And okay. I hear you why you're using that word, but yeah. It's you could also say the same thing about like Australia banning guns. And like, yes, they did just have a mass shooting, but their numbers are nowhere near our numbers.
Yeah.
Even, you know, adjusted for population. There's just, yes, I think that when you make it so that it's no longer culturally normative, and when you make it so that it's not as easily accessible, people are always going to figure out ways to do it, but it not to the same extent as they do now.
Right, but with the guns, there's not like an analog that you can get around it where you like have mass firing spoons or something.
Some kids are going to figure out how to use it regardless, but if there are heavy penalties, or I don't really know how they're going to enforce this. And also, if you just straight up ban cell phones in school, that has another like...
That's a different... Mm-hmm. I agree with that kind of the school
But imagine
thing.
Both of them
I'm
at the same time. What if young people aren't allowed on social media until a certain age, just like young people aren't allowed to drink alcohol until a certain age? Some of them still do. A lot of them still do. But it's not normative. They're not doing it out in public. They're not, you know what I mean? So you ban that, and then you also ban cell phones in schools. I think you'll see a cultural change.
Yeah, but isn't there some discussion about like maybe the way that we treat alcohol leads to a binging culture in America versus like Europe, where they have a little bit more a connection with it? So is the solution actually banning it when that might lead to them going down deeper, darker social media turns like on 4chan or something?
Well, but
like,
I don't think they're saying
like Nazi stuff.
They're not saying they want to ban it altogether. They're saying they want to ban it until the children are at an age at which they can develop a healthy habit with it. And that's the same thing with alcohol.
True.
It'll be
but
an interesting
are they putting
experiment.
Money into funding yeah. that?
We
Just
do
like
need to
social
change.
Media yeah, was right? an interesting experiment.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, but I mean, I agree. But social media is not... I think there was a time when we could safely be like, everybody, every generation gets weird about stuff and it's like the new TV. And I think we can safely say now, like, no, social media is its own beast.
Yeah, the evidence is adding
it's
up.
It's a different animal.
It seems to be pointing a direction.
And it's been completely unregulated till now.
Well, that's it. It's the wild west,
so I think
obviously, because
some guardrails are helpful.
It would be
nice.
We've
got to try something, man. I'm very curious to see how this goes.
Especially for younger people.
But seemingly they police themselves.
Right, like, exactly.
Even now, this legislation, they police themselves on what they justify is somebody under the age of 16. Like there are legal ways that they have to like, you know, upload licenses, but they also have algorithms that determine whether or not you're 16. So what, like clearly they have a desire to have kids on the platform.
Of course That's why they're proactively doing like, now there's like Instagram for teens and stuff, because they're trying to prevent things from happening like are happening in Australia.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They don't want regulation. They want to say, look, we're protecting kids, but they're not. And we know they're not.
But they're not. Right.
But I agree with you,
like,
too.
But then the legislation writes it to like put it in their hands. So it kind of just obfuscates it. And it's like, hey, we passed the bill to protect the kids.
Of course. Yeah.
You know, so it's just like a political sleight of hand. Like, but I don't know. I think it's just a canard. Anyway,
I do agree with you, Ian, that there is a cultural responsibility to develop healthier habits with things that are not going away. And so I think the alcohol example is actually a good one, because our relationship with alcohol can sometimes induce more, you know, binge culture and more abuse.
Yeah.
At the same time, if alcohol was freely available to young people, I think that we would have a lot more health consequences.
There's definitely obviously a balance point. I mean, maybe we should be funding things that are scientific, you know, about like therapies for people, you know, like it would be interesting. This leads me, I want to throw in my skeptical jackass, if you don't mind, and I'm going to expand it pretty wide.
Ooh.
I'm going to say like the whole political class of every flavor, I'm sorry, dragnetting them a little bit, but it showcased like the myth that we had serious people in the room. They're so self-serving or uncaring.
Yep.
And the people that I kind of agree with, I don't know. There's like little bits where I'm like, what are you doing?
Yep.
Or anti-science. It's really just, you hit your head against the wall. Who's running the ship or steering the ship? It's like, what is going on?
It's a good
on?
Observation, Ian. I've said for a long time, if you're going to be skeptical about anything, be skeptical of politics and politicians. That's a good application.
That's the hardest thing. Like, I agree with you, Evan, with this, where it's like, I'm going to, you know, maybe be a little tongue in cheek, but the skepticism against science is like kind of easy. Skepticism with politics is kind of crazy. There's so much out there.
It's a good way for us to check ourselves.
It's an entire industry based on deception.
Yeah.
Right. Totally. I mean, their goal is to not to tell the truth. It's to influence you, influence your vote, influence your behavior.
Positive. Yeah.
You know,
it's persuasion science.
And
it's persuasion.
And they'll say anything. Make it happen.
It's like you hope the person who's most persuadable actually has good ideas.
But I mean, there are some good politicians out there, obviously.
Of course.
But it does seem like the system, there's a selective pressure for people willing to be shamelessly manipulative. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Our political system has the same, we often talk, you know, you use the phrase a lot, Steve, where you're like, it's not a bug, it's a feature. lot of the bugs in our political system, I think, are similar to the bugs in our economic system. When you have a system that's built in such a way that greed is good, when you have a system that's built in such a way that those who kind of take the most continue to be the most rewarded and are given the most perks so they can continue to take more, this is the system you end up with, both politically and economically, which, you know, they're not really two separate systems.
Yeah.
Right. And
I know people will say, like, don't.
And in order to change it, you have to convince these people to make laws to regulate themselves, and they rarely.
Yeah, which is really hard to do. You have to be so politically active, and you have to really hold these people to account. And even then, it's difficult when you're living in this like kind of post whatever reality where the very people who, like you said, Evan, you're asking them to write laws to regulate their themselves are
not
also
human nature.
And not only is it not human nature, we're now living in a culture where, or maybe not a culture, but a system where the very people in power have like little connection to an interest in keeping their constituents happy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so like, how do you hold somebody to account who doesn't care if their constituents care about them? It's strange. Yeah. It's a very strange situation we're in.
It's a weird place. I agree.
And I know people might say, yeah, don't both sides it because there are,
they're not
one
symmetrical.
Side maybe is objective. They're not symmetrical necessarily, but I would say it like this is like, I don't know what's worse. Is like the killer chasing you with the knife or the person who locks you in the room with the killer, you know, like who's like your supposed friend. It's really, I don't know where we are in that spectrum, but it seems bad wherever we are.
I have a category kind of. Ooh. Jackass as well. Everyone involved with the telepathy tapes.
We got a lot of emails on that too.
Oh my God. It's so pervasive. So the quick recap is, you know, they're, you know, claiming to like do these, you know, interviews with autistic children, and they're just doing facilitated communication, and then, which is completely debunked nonsense. But they use the facilitated communication, and then they claim that these autistic kids, not only are they brilliant, these nonverbal kids, but they're psychic. They're reading our minds.
Right.
It is like such a classic pseudoscience, but it's gotten so much play. I can't tell
it's
you
one of the most
people,
popular podcasts out there.
And
now,
people who should freaking know better who have said, oh, what about these kids who are psychic? Like, oh, please stop. It's just amazing.
It's amazing you can repackage the same thing just with like a new name.
We were talking about that literally, you know, a generation ago.
It's just a dumber version of it too. It's just ridiculous.
And more popular. The correlation here is mind-boggling.
All right, Kara, let's pivot to skeptical hero of the year. Who do you have?
I couldn't decide. I was really struggling with this, so I have a few different. I mean, you may have noticed that over the past several weeks, I've been singing the praises of South Park this year.
Yes.
I think Trey Parker and Matt Stone might be up there for me. But also, just the people who turned out to be skeptics that I maybe didn't know were as skeptical as they are. And don't get me wrong, these people aren't perfect. But like John Oliver, Colbert. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been a fan of Colbert. Jon Stewart came back into the fold. But you're seeing these skeptical takes from individuals who have been sort of beloved for a different reason, doing more and more basically public science communication. And then, of course, we have our tireless science communicators across social media platforms. And I think probably the one that I would nominate for this year would be Hank Green.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Hank's pretty cool.
Yeah.
That's a good choice.
He's a good dude. I mean, I think you also should shout out like the writers, the men and women who like write all of John Oliver's.
Of course.
It's probably them actually more than.
The problem is we don't know. Like if I said their names, people might not.
Of course.
I think there's somebody on the writing staff of John Oliver that listens to our show.
I think so.
I don't have proof of that, but enough of what we have said, I have seen shortly thereafter on the show. The one that really got me was the p-hacking one.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Uh-huh. Well, plus they also showed, they talked about our show on John Oliver.
They did.
They flashed
the logo.
Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm.
It was very briefly, nanosecond, but we were there.
Very briefly, they showed
Jimmy
our logo.
Carter, yeah.
So that's pretty good evidence that there's some connection there.
And if they're listening now, maybe they want to reach out.
Yeah, it's confirmation bias, I think.
Similarly, somebody wrote in Hank Green as well, and also Dr. Knock or Morgan McSweeney for their social media activity. Mm. I would add someone who has just been, again, I'd like to focus on people who I see as tirelessly working, even if they're not like seeking big recognition.
Sure.
And for the person this year, somebody who has had a lot of recognition in the past, but Michael Mann, who just for being tireless and also for just staying on top of things and shifting his strategy, you know, to keep up with the climate change denying community.
Yeah.
Like he's staying on top of it. He's not
great.
Giving up. You know, that kind of persistence and energy I really respect. Like this, he's in it for good. He's in it
and
for the long
game.
That's
book
what it
this
takes.
Year, yeah. He co-wrote a book with a vaccine scientist to kind of approach it from both angles, right? Like this is what happens when public trust in science disintegrates.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are a couple other people in that same kind of category, Steve. They're in it they're in it for the long haul, right? Mm-hmm. They understand this is a long-term effort that is required. Mick West comes to mind.
Oh, yeah.
Especially all the work he's done. Why he is not invited onto, you know, panels or congressional testimonies and things like that so that more people can hear him is beyond me, because he can really, really refute a lot of the UFO and UAP stuff, among other things.
Yeah.
Another person who's like that is Timothy Caulfield.
Mm-hmm.
Who continues to fight the fight. Bruce Hood also is one of those people.
Bruce.
And I do want to also give a shout out to Barry Carr. He retired this year. He was the executive director for CSI. But gosh, our relationship with Barry goes back 30 years.
Oh my God. 90s, right?
And he has been so good to us in all that time.
He's been very supportive from the beginning.
Super supportive. Really. Yep. Yes. Even though from a different organization and everything, he has been nothing but great to us. And he deserves recognition for his lifetime effort as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he's one of those people where like it's the cause is what matters, right? Mm-hmm. Skepticism matters.
Yeah. Correct.
It's funny, Steve and Evan, you mentioned tirelessly working in it for the long haul. I'm going to, for this year, for Skeptic of the Year, I'm throwing out Jay. He is the hardest worker that I know. His work has had clearly a profoundly positive impact on this Skeptical podcast and SDU Productions, every project that we do. He's also, I'm so impressed with what's the things that he accomplishes. He's a master at working and negotiating with event vendors and salespeople,
so true.
Which I recently confirmed is actually a form of torture in hell. There's actually a department. Jay is killing it. He misses many of the awesome streaming shows that are out there these days because of his skeptical work ethic. And it annoys the hell out of Steve and me because we have to leave the room to talk about spoilers because Jay's like, I didn't see that. I don't have time to see that. He's just working. It seems like, you know, he's got two young kids, but he's just working night and day, you know. And I just wanted to give a shout out to him. Like, Jay, we appreciate it. We would not be what we are today. We'd be a different beast today if it weren't for all the work that you've put in. To make sure that we could do this and do not just a podcast, but so many other things.
Yeah, it's Jay's a hard
yeah, yeah. So not yeah, such it's so
yeah.
ridiculous.
Yeah, I couldn't imagine doing everything without Jay.
Right? We'd be, you know, we'd get some stuff done, but I don't think we'd do it as good as Jay. Yeah,
almost every day, I'm like, Jay, do this.
He's a Sherpa. He's a Sherpa.
Jay had to bow out of the show because of his flu. He's really
we sent him to bed.
So that's why that's not why he's not participating in this discussion. But
he's weakly saying thanks.
No kidding.
So we got a couple of more emails from listeners with their votes. So one person voted for Emily Willingham for clear, responsible, skeptical analysis of emotionally charged pseudoscience.
Yeah.
And we referenced her during the telepathy tapes discussion. Bring that up again. Kara, you got a couple of votes from listeners for this year. For everything that you do, not just the SGU. And a lot of people really appreciate your role on the SGU because, you know, Bob, Jay, and I are brothers. Evan is basically a brother. He's a very close friend. We've known him for a long time. And we can be a little, you know, close. You know what I mean? It could be we're a little bit of an echo chamber.
The
audience really appreciates the fact that you are a different perspective and you're not afraid to push back on anything that we say.
It's funny. I was going to say earlier that some of my favorite episodes looking back or just some of my favorite experiences with the SGU, and this speaks to the talk that you actually gave at CSI. Was that earlier this year or was that last year?
It was
when skeptics disagree.
Yeah.
Right? Like
That's the fun part.
I really enjoy when we have differing opinions about things and we can kind of talk about the nuance. And, you know, when it comes to the really big stuff, we're definitely all, you know, on the same team rooting for the same cause. But sometimes we disagree about how we should get there.
Sure. Yeah, which is fine.
Healthy.
That's the discussion we should be having.
Right.
I always say, like, on climate change, we shouldn't be wasting our time debating about whether it's happening or It's freaking happening. Discussion worth happening is what's the best strategy to deal with it? And there's lots of to talk about there.
Mm-hmm. Should we do geoengineering or is that too risky? Should we do this or what? Oh, man.
You just burn money. I think that happens.
You could.
I think that might help.
Ian, who is your skeptical hero?
All of the ideas you had were so good. I could not think of one. I think I'm doomer brained. I've been on TikTok or social media so long. I don't know what it is. I mean, I think I said this last time and I'm going to do it again. I'm just going to cheat. It's like the listeners, anyone who's still committed while seeing the world kind of fall apart.
Right,
it's maybe our skeptical project over the last decades hasn't fully fixed everything or fixed enough or fixed anything. Who knows? But at least you guys are hopefully in with us in the fight as we're sinking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I don't know. Just keep up. Keep looking forward. You know, there is some power in positivity to throw it back to the beginning. You know, but
it's called strategic optimism.
Yes.
I'm a firm believer in strategic optimism.
Yeah.
Avoiding self-defeating nihilism that doesn't serve any purpose.
Great.
I know. It's hard, it's hard for me to be strategically optimistic.
Well, and sometimes it takes, and that's why I always go back to that thing I said before, that hope is a moving target.
Yeah.
You have to sometimes take a step away from the issue and come back into it and look at how the parameters have changed. Like you mentioned, you've got to be strategically optimistic, and that has to do with understanding where are we now, what can be done. We might not be where we were 15 years ago or 30 years ago or whatever, but like maybe we can compare ourselves to where we were 100 years ago. Or, you know, one of the things that was always really inspiring to me is when I talk to my friends who come from countries who have been through constitutional crises or who have experienced authoritarianism and they got through it.
Yeah. And we'll get through it.
We'll get through it.
Yeah.
It feels unique to us, but it's not unique in the world. It is unique in the world in some ways. I mean, I'm not arguing that, but there will be a future ahead of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Keep building community, you know, and like, you know, helping each other, you know, in whatever way we can.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of my strategic optimism is informed by my career as a physician, right? Because talk about you're in a situation every day with your patients where you have to do everything you can, you know, to be an advocate for your patient and to get the best outcome with and everything that can possibly go wrong goes wrong, right? But you still, and all the challenges that you could possibly have are there, but you still have to, at the end of the day, you have to have the best outcome you can possibly get. And so sometimes you have to say, well, I don't know what's going on, but if this were anything treatable, this is what it would be. So let's treat that and see what happens. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, that's strategic optimism. Like, let's plan, you know, you always have to hope for the best, plan for the worst, but sometimes hoping for the best means acting as if this is something that you can fix. And then if it doesn't, you know, you did the best you could, right? You gave it the best odds you can. Same thing like with global warming. If we assume it's hopeless, then it is hopeless. By definition, you know, that makes the reality. But if you say, all right, I'm going to go down fighting, or I'm going to, you know, do everything I can and constantly change strategy and try, like Michael Mann is doing, why I picked him, like just constantly doing what we can do to make it less bad or try to move things in the right direction. And, you know,
that's the key.
It's a bit of a leap of faith. I don't know that it's going to affect the world, but it's better than doing nothing, right? It's better than just giving into the negativity.
Well, and it will affect the world because, once again, hope is a moving target. And sometimes we're not talking about fixing something or putting things back the way they were. Sometimes we're talking about making it less bad.
Yeah, less bad is not
but less bad,
bad
is
a good goal. Yeah,
it is.
Yes, and so like basically, I think one of the only goals we got left with climate change is make it as little bad as we can. It really
is. It's all about being less bad. Absolutely. Yep. Okay, let's move on to our In Memoriam segment. This is where we look back at all the people we lost this year, focusing on scientists and skeptics, but we throw in some other, you know, celebrity favorites that we have. I have a list. I don't know if you guys have any names, but I'll just go through my list. If I missed anybody, then you can chime in.
Are they in reverse alphabetical order?
No. I'm going to start with a couple of skeptics. Top of the list, of course, is Joe Nickell.
Yes.
Joe Nickell is a tireless skeptic, a real, you know, he was an investigator. He was like really, there was a time.
Oh my God, yeah.
When he was really the only full-time, he might have been the only full-time skeptical investigator in the world.
Yeah.
And he would do the nitty-gritty hard work. You know, he wouldn't just write opinions or use broad brushstrokes. He would do the nitty-gritty investigative work, and he would do the work that we would cite to say, look, he did all the hard work, and this is what that analysis shows, etc. It was really indispensable. He's also someone like Barry Carr that we met very early on in our skeptical careers, who was, you know, very friendly, very supportive, of great resource.
Yeah.
And, yeah, he was just, you know, a fantastic guy. Really sorry, you know, to see him go.
Yeah, that one hurt, man. Like, yeah. Damn.
There's also one of our listeners emailed us to remind us that Randy Snyder died this year. So he was also an influential skeptic, mainly in the ex-Mormon community. Did you know him, Kara?
No, but we had him on the show.
We did have him on the show once. Yeah.
Back in, I think, episode 416.
Yeah, man, a long time ago. And then there was also Robert Lee Nadeau, who was an American academic and activist against climate denial, not known for outspoken criticism of climate change, misinformation, and deniers. So those are the three people kind of in the skeptical category that I found. And then for scientists, I think, there's a few famous scientists who died this year. Jane Goodall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not too long ago.
Yeah. Dr. Goodall.
She had an amazing career, obviously best known for her work with chimpanzees, but also a tireless advocate just for the environment and animal welfare and
I criticized her once.
Yeah, we did. We did. She said some gullible things about Bigfoot.
And nobody's above criticism.
Look. Not all scientists are skeptics at the same level that we are, right? Or not exposed to what we concentrate on. They're concentrating on the work they're doing, which is fine. right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but then they kind of speak outside of their element a little bit, and this is what happens, and it can happen to the best of them, and Jane Goodall is an example of that.
Skepticism is a unique skill set. You do not automatically go along with being a scientist, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think she ever claimed to be a skeptic either.
No.
Correct. Right. She was not pretending to be something she's not. Mm-hmm. Right.
And also, the other big name this year was James Watson. Also, beyond any criticism, right?
Yeah.
I have a decently representative quote about him. This is from science historian Nathaniel Comfort, said, the most famous scientist of the 20th century and the most infamous of the 21st.
Yeah.
Which kind of does it a little bit of justice right there. I mean, racist views, sexist views were not good. He worked for decades and moved up the ladder at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, CSHL. And in 2019, they revoked his emeritus status and they condemned him for, I quote, the misuse of science to justify prejudice. I mean, mm-hmm. that's just like, damn, man.
And it's important to remember, too, that it's not just – I think sometimes we hear people – and we had this argument or this conversation before where it's like, well, he was of an era. And, you know, some people might say, hey, he lived a little too long. Like, if he had died earlier, maybe he wouldn't have gone down in history that way. But we have people like Attenborough who are 101, right? Like, we've got people alive today who were alive when he was alive who didn't espouse those views. We have to remember that.
But of course, he's the most famous for discovering DNA helix structure with Crick. You know, Watson and Crick, everybody knows those names.
And Rosalind Franklin.
He used data and ideas from Rosalind Franklin and biophysicist Maurice Wilkins without attributing them, and they didn't get, and not even with Franklin's permission. Mm-hmm. So that was terrible. You know, it's like, women do a lot of the hard work that, the two guys took all the credit, got the Nobel Prize. It was terrible. But of course, we have to say that Rosalind Franklin didn't get the Nobel Prize primarily because she was dead at the time it was awarded, and they don't give posthumous prizes.
But that doesn't
erase the fact that, you know, that she was abused.
Right. And even if it was normative at the time, that doesn't make it right.
No, of course not. It wasn't normative or right at the time.
Well, it's still normative that women don't really get as many Nobel Prizes.
Sure. Yeah, they don't get as much credit.
Yeah.
Bob, do you know Chen Ning Yang?
I don't think so.
Physicist whose work on symmetry paved the way for the standard model of particle physics.
Oh, I know I've come across his name. Probably just like two initials and Yang, and that was like, he was on papers that I've read. So I probably have.
Massive, work for the standard model, which of course, the standard model is at the core of physics today.
Absolutely.
There's another physicist. This is an astrophysicist, George Smoot.
So he won
the Nobel Prize in Physics in 2006 for his work on the Cosmic Background Explorer. John Mather led to the discovery of the black body form of anisotropy of the cosmic microwave background radiation.
Huge, man. That's great. We probably mentioned him on the show, potentially in 2006.
Oh, didn't David Baltimore die this year, too?
Yep.
He's another Nobel laureate, right?
Yep, Nobel Prize for discoveries concerning the interaction between tumor viruses and the genetic material of this cell.
Well, and he did so much in, in the HIV/AIDS space.
There are a bunch of other Nobel laureates who died this year. George Smith, 2009 Nobel Prize in Physics for the invention of an imaging semiconductor circuit, the CCD sensor.
Charge couple device.
Exactly, which is like all of digital photography.
Every camera, right?
Yeah.
Wow, that's huge. And by the way, David Baltimore discovered reverse transcriptase.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Like, that's enormous.
Yeah, that's enormous.
Can you
tell for the audience and my sake what that is?
Well, it explained basically how HIV can replicate. And it's like one of the foundational understandings. We wouldn't have gene therapy without understanding reverse transcriptase.
Yeah. It's how you get RNA back into DNA, basically.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And that's how it gets embedded into the genome by viruses. Yep.
John Gurdon, Nobel Prize for research into turning mature cells into stem cells. We just talked about this, too, about the stem cell ban and how that was sidestepped by this science, figuring out how to turn skin cells into stem cells. So he got a Nobel Prize for that research. Hamilton Smith, Nobel Prize in 1978 for discovering restriction enzymes, also huge in biology. So I think that was all the Nobel laureates that I came across. But a few other physicists or a few other scientists who were not Nobel laureates but did work. Richard Garwin. Anybody?
Ooh, that rings a bell. No.
So he came up with the first design for a hydrogen bomb.
Oh.
Wow, really?
Yeah. Maybe not the legacy you want, but it was still important, you know.
So not just a fission bomb, a fusion bomb.
A fusion bomb, yeah, a fusion
bomb. Yeah, right.
In the 50s, I suppose.
Xavier Le Pichon helped create the field of plate tectonics.
Oh. That's a cool name, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, right?
Elizabeth Verba. Anybody recognize that name?
I do.
Elizabeth Verba from evolutionary biology. So she's somebody, I read a ton of Stephen Jay Gould, so I know about her through that work. So she was also at Yale, so the reason why I know her. So she developed the turnover pulse hypothesis, coined the phrase exaptation with Stephen Jay Gould.
Nice.
Wow.
So the turnover pulse hypothesis is the notion that an ecosystem reaches a stability and then something happens to destabilize the ecosystem, whether it is climate change or some key index species goes extinct or the invasion of another species or whatever. The ecosystem gets destabilized, and then in a pulse of turnover, a lot of the species change until you reach a new stable ecosystem.
Wow.
And what is exaptation? Who wants to define that word for me?
Oh, I used to know.
We did it on the show.
Yeah. Exaptation.
It's when one trait gets used for something different later, right?
Yeah, it's evolved for one purpose and then it gets
co-opted
for something else.
Yeah.
That's what evolution is, man. That's
totally
awesome. That's
critical concept of evolution. Absolutely. Darlene Christian Hoffman confirmed the existence of seaborgium, element 106.
Nice.
Wow.
Seaborgium.
That sounds fake. That sounds fake. Right? It's ridiculous.
Mark Norell or Norrell. Kara, this is a dinosaur guy. Do you know him? Mark Norell discovered the first theropod embryo.
Oh, cool.
And also known for his description of many feathered dinosaurs.
Oh, wow.
Really neat.
Yeah, good work. All right, a few astronauts, most famously, Jim Lovell.
Jim Lovell.
Jim Lovell.
Oh, yeah.
We talked about him on the show. So he was the first one to go to the moon twice, I believe.
Yes.
Wow.
He is Houston, right? We have a problem fame. Right. We've had a problem. Right.
We've had him.
Yeah.
He was 97.
Hollywood. Yeah.
Good
right?
for him.
Talk about, oof.
Good run, man.
Good run.
Especially after, surviving what he had to survive is amazing.
Yeah. Captain Frederick H. Hawk, who was a space shuttle captain, died this year. And not really an astronaut, but kind of in that same vein, Felix Baumgartner.
Oh,
At the time, it's a record.
The space jumper.
Yeah, that is a record.
Yeah.
For the highest space jump.
Jumped from the edge of space. Died in a paragliding crash. I mean, paragliding is dangerous.
Yeah, man.
Well, these like extreme athletes.
I know. Like jumping from space is dangerous too.
I don't know how they get insurance, frankly.
Somehow safer jumping from space.
Somehow safer.
he was only 56, right? Yeah.
That's a bummer.
That's my age.
Yeah, that's really.
So that's the scientists and technologists and space guys. A few just celebrities I thought I'd throw out there.
Mm-hmm.
We very recently lost Rob Reiner. Very sad story.
Oh,
he and his wife were stabbed to death by their troubled son.
Allegedly by the son,
Very terrible thing.
Ugh.
It's so sad. Just imagine having a child who has mental health issues, drug use issues. Mm-hmm. It's so heartbreaking. But then, of course, and now ending super tragically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Jeez.
June Lockhart. Anybody know who she is?
Yes. Oh, my God. Lost in Space.
Lost in Space,
Lassie.
Mom. And Lassie.
And Lassie.
Oh, wow.
Robert Redford, of course, probably the most.
Robert Redford.
Oh, yeah. Actor.
Hulk Hogan died this year. I missed that.
He did. Yeah. Yes. Mm. Heart attack. Was battling cancer and leukemia.
Oh, wow.
At the time.
He was pretty sick. Yeah.
His heart gave. Well, and what he did to his body and stuff over the years, I can only imagine what kind of toll that took. With the drugs he took and performance drugs and everything else, but still, he's an icon. He's whether you liked him or hated him, definitely mm-hmm. on Icon.
Ozzy Osbourne.
Oh yeah.
Sad in that he performed his last concert a couple of weeks before he left.
Right.
And it was his farewell show.
Oh, well, I mean, that's kind of great then.
Yeah, it was the way to go, I guess.
Yeah.
You know.
All right, who knows who Drew Struzan is? Drew Struzan. No chance you'd recognize his name. But you do recognize his work.
Oh.
He's an artist.
Okay.
Famous
paintings?
for innovating the movie poster. Responsible for such iconic movie posters as Star Wars, Indiana Jones, Back to the Future, E.T., Blade Runner, The Goonies, First Blood, Bob, nice. You'll love this one, The Shawshank Redemption, The Thing,
nice.
And the Thing, Harry Potter classic. And the Sorcerer's Stone.
Wow. So they called on him when they needed him.
Yeah. So did he invent that kind of stacking pyramidal-ish shape?
Exactly. Okay, that was his thing.
That's very cool.
What was it? Stacking what?
Well, you know how think of Star Wars movie poster. At least what comes into my head is like the head, the people's heads in a pyramidal shape or a triangular shape.
Yeah.
You know, kind of like, or a tree or whatever.
I had a Star Wars poster.
You would be surprised though at the calculus that goes into determining whose head is where and where the names are. This is all about negotiating with the actors and the actors' people, because sometimes you have the people. The stars, A, B, and C, their heads, but above them, it's C, A, B, because it's a different set of rules for where the name goes to where the head goes and how big it is. It's this whole thing that probably makes it a horrible process to go through to figure out whose head goes where, how big, where the names go. It's this whole thing that I read. It was fascinating.
Maybe they should just make the movies better, you know, and not focus so much on that.
Sorry. Well, when I think about those iconic movie posters, I also think about the typeface and the actual title of the movie, how it takes up so much and it has such a presence in those movie posters.
You could look at a movie, but it's funny though. Sometimes, like recently, I saw a movie poster for a movie that on paper sounded like something I would like, but taking one look at the movie poster, I'm like, that movie sucks because the poster is so bad that this can't possibly be even a halfway decent movie. And I was right when I did more research. It was a horrible movie.
I mean, would you say that about The Room? Have you seen Tommy Wiseau's The Room? It's like a ridiculous cover, but it's one of the best terrible movies ever.
Oh, yeah.
So, I don't know.
1977 Star Wars poster sold for a record $3.875 million in auction this month. Just this month.
That doesn't surprise me.
Wow, an original.
It's an amazing poster.
Remember, you guys are all like, I would pay that if I had it.
I had it. Like, talk about the $3 million on my wall.
That Star Wars font itself is iconic. You have Darth Vader's head, you know, Luke Skywalker with the lightsaber over his head, Princess Leia. Han Solo is not even in the picture. You got the droids in the background, and you got the X-Wing fighters, like a squadron of them in the background as well, and the Death Star hovering.
And the Death Star.
It's ingrained in my memory. Yeah, it's amazing.
And Drew Struzan also created the Revenge of the Jedi poster, which is also famous because he made the poster, and then they changed the title of the movie, and they took all the posters away. So if you have one of those, you have a rare item.
Oh, yeah.
Do you think anything nowadays could achieve that kind of rare item status, or have we jumped the shark with all that kind of stuff?
Oh, that's a good question. Is it like, hard to predict.
It's hard to predict, obviously, because like, it'd be financially beneficial to you if you could.
Well, I think so, but there's just a lot more like chaff.
Stuff. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Chaff's the bad stuff, right? Sure, we want the wheat. Yeah. Sure. It's just a lot more chaff.
I don't know. What can you do with chaff?
If you have the first iPhone in the box, I imagine that's worth some bucks.
Oh, yeah, maybe.
Yeah, it could be.
Are you guys
ready?
Save
all your junk. Yeah, go ahead.
Ready?
Yeah.
Ready for the final science or fiction?
Oh, boy.
Does this count?
It counts.
I think so.
Yeah. Then I'm not ready.
It's time for science or fiction.
All right. Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. But on this episode, first, we're going to go over statistics for 2025.
Nice.
So we'll give you just the percentages. So
don't be depressed already. Come on.
In last place.
Higher math.
Last place is J at 57.4%.
That's 57.4 is
that's not bad.
That's really
very
not
good.
Bad. Yeah.
Last place used to be, we would have 30s and 40s in some
years. He was busy negotiating those rooms, okay?
So you guys all generally had a good year. I definitely
are we getting better?
Or
are you slacking?
Oh.
I think you're getting better. I mean, it's a man. I thought I came up with good items and you sniff
you
it
did.
Out. Like, what the? You go, I don't know what's going on. I have no idea. It's this one. Like, shit.
Yeah, like, it's like picking stocks, you know?
And. And your reasoning is usually solid, damn it.
Kara's is.
I got to get one level more devious. In second place, or second from the bottom, is Evan at 63.8%.
Wow,
which again,
63?
That's a
good. That's really
number.
Good.
Yeah.
Very, very respectful.
Yeah, man.
I'm happy.
Bob, you squeaked by Evan with 64%.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, you suck, Evan.
Awesome. Only by 1%.
I'll take second place. I mean, I think we could all agree there's no defeating the Kara beast.
And Kara had a great year, 77%.
That's better
than
usual.
Even try?
That's a little bit more than 3 out of 4. That's not bad.
Yeah,
that's more like an anomaly.
That might be your, I think that's your best year.
We need to investigate this a little bit.
Well, I wonder how many times I went first. I bet you I think one of my skills is riding on you guys' coattails.
Yeah.
It's recognizing which of you are making better arguments.
It's tough.
I don't know. I don't think you need our help.
No,
I don't think you need our help too much.
I bet you if you look at the number of times that I win when I go first, it's a real low.
It's tough because I hear it. I want to be fair with who I go first, but I don't want everyone riding on your coattails every week either. So
right, that's the thing. You have to be smart about it. And a lot of times it's about the topic,
it's about
right?
The topic.
Like when it's a physics thing, throw me first. It doesn't matter.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. And then Steve gives me a dream science or fiction last week. And it's like, all right, I'm going to get this one. And then everyone got it. Like, what the hell, man? That's not how it's supposed to go.
That wasn't my plan, Bob. I was hoping for everyone to get it wrong and then for you to school them at the end. But what can you do?
they sussed it out. And like, I can't disagree. So, okay. Whatever.
Andrea Jones-Roy played 3 science or fictions. She got a 0%. Don't tell anyone.
Well, she's got to play more.
Like, that's
George.
Three, I mean.
George also played 3 times. He had a 33%. Got 1 out of 3, correct?
Okay.
3.
1 out of 3 ain't bad.
Justin Dobb and Adam Russell both played 1. And got them correct, so they had 100%.
Oh,
nice. Nice.
So they win.
Winner, winner.
Yeah, what do they win?
That's the best.
Lee played once and got it wrong, so I had 0%.
You didn't play once?
I didn't play this year. I did every
one. We need to fix that. Yeah.
I did every one.
We should fix that.
But every time, I've only done it a handful of times, and I get swept every time. I'm not good at writing science or fiction.
Yeah,
we'll have you do a couple
this year. It's a skill.
Yeah. Up everyone else's average.
Okay.
It was a good year. Yeah.
Are you ready for the last? Yeah. Science or fiction of 2025.
Will this impact Bob standing in my standing?
It could. If you win and he doesn't, Bob. you may flop. You may get into
shit.
No.
Into second place, Evan.
Bob.
Evan. Ian, Ian, what was your record from last year? You played just once at the end of the year last year.
I don't remember getting last year right. I think the year prior I did.
Okay.
And then I don't remember. Chatters. I say chatters. We're not streaming. What am I doing? listeners, tell me if I'm wrong.
Okay. So here are the items for 2025.
Uh-oh.
Okay.
I usually do variations on some kind of look back of 225 for this science or fiction. The specific theme I chose, these are all items that I blogged about on my neurological blog.
Oh, interesting.
Who's reading the blog?
So this will be easy for anybody who obsessively reads my blog. Okay. Which, of course, why wouldn't you? Hello.
Yes. Right.
Hello. Available at
Neurologica.
Neurologicablog.com/neurologica. Item number one, an analysis finds that existing policies on use of plastic bags are mostly ineffective, on average reducing plastic bag waste by less than 10%. All right, number two, an extensive genetic and cellular analysis finds that birds evolved the information-carrying neurons in their brain mostly independently from mammals. And item number three, researchers presented a new gene editing system that is even better than CRISPR called the TIGER-TAS system. And as I usually do, we go in reverse order of your score. So
So Adam.
Yep. But Ian, here, Adam. Ian will have you probably go last. So we'll start with Evan.
Oh, I see. So the policies on use of plastic bags are mostly ineffective, on average reducing plastic bag waste by less than 10%. Okay. Why would you have blogged about this? I have a feeling you actually did blog about
good
all
angle
three of these, right? And it's
I did blog about all three of these. I just changed.
It's not like you made one up wholesale and never
I'll give
even
you that
blogged it. Okay. Yeah, I have a feeling this one feels like science to me, and because I don't know, there seems to be a shift almost a little bit back into the acceptance of plastic bags. For a long time, right, they were banned, and I don't know, I imagine they're still banned in some states and some places. But I've kind of seen them creeping back into my world in a sense. So in that would say that basically this really wasn't working, it wasn't effective, and therefore we don't, you know, we're giving up the ghost here. So I have a feeling that one's going to be right. The second one about genetic and cellular analysis about the birds that evolved the information carrying neurons in their brain mostly independently from mammals. That strikes me as significant, although I couldn't tell you exactly why that would be the case. Steve, you love birds, and so this one I'm going to just rely more on you than the actual science itself. Would you have the fortitude, let's say, to go ahead and pervert one of your stories about birds and make it into the fiction, right? I don't know. Are you more of a purist? Like, it would be like, no, I can't do that to birds because I love birds and everything about them, and it's my hobby and everything. So that one leads me to believe it's also science, which leads me to the last one. Now, the Tiger TAS system, gosh, did we talk about this on the show as well? We talked about several CRISPR items this year, and this seems familiar, even better than CRISPR. Gosh, so this one is also science. Therefore, all three are science.
Very good.
I will have to say, therefore, gee whiz, I have to say something. I have to guess. Even better than CRISPR, Tiger TAS. I mean, a new system, why wouldn't it be better than CRISPR? That's the point. Why would they develop something that wouldn't be better or just does something differently? I will say the one about plastic bags is the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
I don't remember too many details about Tiger TAS, but I think I'm going to say that one is science. God, I wish I remember the details. It seems like a lot longer ago, Steve, than 2025, dude. Like that seems like a 2023 memory to me. But
then it would be the fiction.
Are you sure you talked about it this year, or is that the premise that I miss? Am I incorrect about the premise?
Just the premise is I blogged about it this year.
Okay, all right. So I'll say that one is science. The bird one, the bag one makes sense. It makes more sense as it's written, and I think you probably or maybe would not really want to write about it if it were the opposite, maybe. It kind of strikes me that way. And I'm just, the neurons in the birds, man, that's just like, neurons at that level, neurons, I think, were one of the things and that would be conserved to such a degree that I wouldn't imagine they would be that different. So I'm going to say that one's fiction.
Ooh, interesting.
Okay, Kara.
Oof. So it's funny because I think all of them, I think these are really well written because they're all, I don't know, they all stick out in their own way. Like the one that Bob just went with, right? The birds evolving information carrying neurons in their brain, mostly independently from mammals. To me, that's the most holy crap. Like if that's science, that's
right?
A big deal, right? And it seems the most counterintuitive to me. But that doesn't mean it's not science. And the one about Tiger TAS, or Tigger TAS. I love what Evan said. Well, of course it's better than CRISPR. It wouldn't be newsworthy if they're like, we came up with a system that's worse than CRISPR. the fact that I don't remember this at all is really, that's a bummer. And I don't know if that is an indictment of my memory or my attention. I'm not really sure. But this one definitely seems the most, well, not the most plausible, but this one seems plausible. And if this one is science, that's like amazing. So this one's, holy crap, that's amazing. The bird one is, oh my gosh, I can't believe that's true. And then the plastic bag one, it's funny that you put your nickel down on that, Evan, because it sounded like you weren't going to go with this at all.
Yeah,
you
right. Like, no, but 10%. I was basing it only on my own personal experience, which is useless, right?
Yeah. That's why it is. My personal experience is that I live in California, right? And so we are in many ways a leader in this type of regulation. And from what I understand, there are, first of all, there are a ton of loopholes and there are a ton of reasons why plastic bag bans do fail. Because like here, just as an aside, there's this stupid thing, and I think they're about to outlaw it in LA, but there's this stupid thing where you can sell reusable plastic bags. They're like slightly thicker.
Yeah.
And so the idea is that people will use them more often, but it's just worse plastic to break down in the environment.
The
it's like, it's a bad idea. Yeah. Paper. Right? Like,
paper,
I only use paper bags.
Or
reusable.
You know, for the reusables. Reusables all the time.
That's the
like,
way
if you're
going to
ban plastic, you have to ban it outright. But, and we've got to remember that the way you worded this is very careful, Steve. An analysis finds that existing policies on use of plastic bags are mostly ineffective. So that includes all those loopholes. But then it says, on average, reducing plastic bag waste by less than 10%. And I just don't think that's true. I think places where there are policies in place, we see a bigger reduction. I think we could see an even bigger reduction, though, if there weren't so many like stupid loopholes. But 10% seems really low to me. So I'm going to say that's the fiction.
Okay, and Ian.
Okay, so I'm going to go backwards a little bit just because when I heard you say CRISPR and Tiger Tass, I was like, it has to be ending with Tastic. Tiger Tastic. I was like, this is clearly
Tiger
a lie. But then when I you sent it to us, so I saw it written, I was like, okay, maybe it's not. Maybe it is actually scientists, you know, writing a fun little name. At least in my head, that's how it comes out with. I could see what it's saying even better seems a weird thing, as opposed to like maybe it has this different use case that is maybe more tailored to something. So maybe that's where the even better thing is, like that they have slightly different specialties, whatever. So that seems like science to me, even though the even better thing kind of threw me a little bit. The birds, maybe I just don't understand how bird evolution and mammals, you know, evolved, but I don't see why they wouldn't be independently evolving information carrying neurons, as opposed to like what dependency would they have?
Well,
on each other?
The other option is that that all vertebrates sort of have the same neurons, right?
Like, oh, okay. We all have a common ancestor.
You have a common ancestor. Oh, okay. So did neurons develop in the common ancestor, or they independently
after the fact
develop in birds and mammals?
I see. Okay.
Definitely.
So that does interesting add a wrinkle. I'm still going to go with my gut and say that the other word that throws me off is the mostly independently. It's like, well, maybe just like completely independently, but whatever. I still think that seems reasonable, whatever. Mm-hmm. Convergent evolution. I don't know if that's even like the right terminology to use
it
that.
It is.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Thank you. I win. then an analysis finds that existing policies on use of plastic bags are mostly ineffective and bellow. Okay. I mean, I do hope that regulation does something. Like, please, God, let that be somewhere. I mean, I will agree that, like, putting a lot of the onus on, like, the consumer seems to be, you know, maybe that's, like, the wrong place when so many corporations pollute, blah, blah, blah. We all know that, I think. You know, so, but I would hope, I don't see plastic bags unless I go to like Virginia or Pennsylvania, and then it's like, they just don't give a damn. But like Connecticut or LA or like, you know, California, it's like, I don't see them. I don't even see those thicker plastic bags. It's funny that when you get to a certain thickness, they become like a reusable plastic bag that you don't want to throw out. But there's like this middle ground thickness where I'm like, yeah, it's close enough. I do want to throw it out. But anyway, yeah, it's gotta be that's the fiction, that it is actually effective. Like, it is reducing plastic bag waste. Please.
Okay.
Science, please.
Bob, which one did you pick again?
The neurons.
The neurons. Okay. All right. So you all agree on the third one. So we'll start there. Researchers presented a new gene editing system that is even better than CRISPR, called the Tiger Tass system. You all think this one is science, and this one is Science. This is science. Yes, and we did talk about this on the show.
Yeah, and it was better in a couple
areas. It's better.
Areas.
It's got some interesting advantages. So it works on both strands of the DNA in terms of finding the plate, you know, the match, and therefore it is more reliable. And it's also not limited in the way that CRISPR is. CRISPR, you know, requires a certain particular sequence on the RNA to be able to find it. And those are the so-called PAM sequences, the proto-spacer adjacent motifs. Jeez. Right? So CRISPR is PAM dependent. Tiger is PAM independent, which means it's more versatile and it's more accurate. So it has the potential to be even better than CRISPR.
So it replaces CRISPR? Like, yeah,
it's
just going to do that.
On it, right? Ooh, I haven't heard much about it lately, though.
Well, it just came out this year. You know, CRISPR's
also, we've
got to
remember, we don't hear much, like, we just hear the word CRISPR a lot, too. And I think that's become a catch-all. Like,
right, like a zero.
You don't often hear, like, CRISPR-Cas9 versus CRISPR-Cas10.
Yeah,
or
you're right.
CRISPR,
right.
You know, like, I think people just say CRISPR.
When they mean genetic, one of the newer genetic systems.
Yeah, that could actually happen.
Latest CRISPR thing.
Technology.
Yeah.
So is it like a complete replacement of all things CRISPR, or is it just like... No. Okay,
no,
so
it wouldn't. You know, it wouldn't completely replace CRISPR because there are things for which CRISPR is fine.
Okay.
But there might be some specific use cases where the advantages of Tiger would make it worth it.
Mm. Whatever happened, Steve, I remember we talked about a new system that didn't cut anything. It basically just silenced the gene.
That's an application of CRISPR. Again, that's the CRISPR... the attachment to the CRISPR.
Yeah. That was
it's basically a toggle. You could turn genes on and off without breaking them. So you could turn them back on again. Just silences the gene. Yeah,
but
that's
the thing
being
is,
used.
It's probably being used.
It's totally being used.
We're just not always like so specific about the exact mechanism at play because it gets really in the weeds.
Yeah, I got to look at that specifically. I thought it could replace a lot of regular CRISPR-Cas9. I mean, because it just seemed like you're not cutting anything out. So you're just silencing and you could just turn it on and off. If there's a mistake, turn it on. You don't have to even worry about cutting or reinserting or anything. I don't know. It just seemed like a great advance that I just don't remember coming across in my news item searches every week.
Well, you need to read the Neurological blog.
Dig deep and you'll see.
Yeah, I doubt it's even being really highlighted.
All right, let's go back to number two. An extensive genetic and cellular analysis finds that birds evolved the information-carrying neurons in their brain mostly independently from mammals. Bob, you think this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. So this is a very interesting news item. Have you ever heard the term the pallium?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Nope.
Bob, where do you hear it from?
Isn't that the name of the publication for the high school we went
to,
Canterbury?
Yes, it is. that's
what do you mean? How can you say that then? Have anyone heard of something only Bob and I
the newspaper of the
it
means something. It's not a random word that they made up. The pallium is basically the cerebral cortex, right? So they use that as the name for their monthly magazine. But so the question is, and all vertebrates have a pallium, right? But the question is, how much of the structure, especially at the cellular and genetic level, how much of that is from a common vertebrate ancestor and how much of it were evolved independently in reptiles, birds, and mammals.
And they are really different. Like
organizationally,
it's
different.
It's really different in birds than it is in mammals.
Is that all organizational? Is that the networks or is that the actual neurons themselves?
Cellular level.
Right. Nice. Yeah. And how would, I definitely wouldn't know that. I know that like from a mapping perspective, it's wildly different.
So they did a thorough analysis, looked at both the cells themselves and the genes. And what they found was, I'll quote one of the researchers, their neurons are born in different locations and developmental times in each species, indicating that they are not comparable neurons derived from a common ancestor. So this one is science. Bah. Sorry, Bob.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
And crazy.
But there were a couple of neurons in common. That's why I had to say mostly. But most of the neurons were like different genetics, different developmental biology. These evolved independently.
Damn, man.
Yeah.
That's pretty awesome.
That's
wild.
Wow. Yeah.
So then what about other like vertebrates? Though, because like it's mammals, birds, like what, reptiles, amphibians, they have a common neurological ancestor.
Well, yeah, but we all evolved from fish, right? We're basically all fish. Evolutionarily speaking, we are all fish.
Right.
But yeah, that's why they looked at the derived, you know, groups, the reptiles, birds, and mammals.
But are reptiles, did their, I guess they don't really have a cortex, but they still have a
they
pallium.
They do. They have a pallium.
Yeah. They don't have a neocortex. Yeah. Oh, but okay.
They got the newsletter.
There you go.
Is theirs more similar to birds?
No.
No. So all three of us are just different.
Okay. All three are different.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Cool. All right, let's go back to number one. An analysis finds that existing policies on use of plastic bags are mostly ineffective, on average reducing plastic bag waste by less than 10%. That is, of course, the fiction, because the truth is they're quite effective. So you guys, your wish list came true. They are, so the study that I was writing about compared states with plastic bag policies, just any plastic bag policy, to states without any policy, and they found that the plastic bag waste was reduced by 25 to 47%, so at the high end, cut in half, which is still not good enough, but that's
right.
That's zero significant. That's pretty. So they work.
I can't believe there are states with zero policies in place on plastic bags.
Hey, woke is back. Well,
there's some states.
Policies are woke, Kara. You should know that.
Yeah, there's some states that have 500,000 people in them.
So those 500,000 people, it would be so easy for them to not use plastic bags.
Yeah, what, Rhode Island? What are they doing with those bags?
There's no federal regulation.
No, of course. Oh.
This is why it was easy to compare states, because it's all statewide.
Well, that's because big plastic bag is all over.
You guys heard about the woke fonts, right?
Yes, of course. Yes. Times New Roman, I think.
Calibri. Calibri is a real thing.
Oh, no, my God.
Like, I get that you're being funny, but like, big plastic is the reason for this.
Big plastic.
Big plastic, yeah. No, it's true.
I think you guys are missing the important takeaway here.
Oh, yes.
Bob has fallen into third place.
Did he?
No. Even more important and tragic as that is this. I just realized, you know, Carrie gets what, 77? I think she has an absolutely unfair advantage being and living in California, and we should tell her you got to move to Texas to make it, to even it out a little bit.
Hey, or Florida.
But to be fair, Bob, I'm from Texas, and I did live in Florida.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
So okay, but
I have lived in Texas longer than I have lived in California so far, and I lived in Florida for 1 year and New York for 1 year. So those they sort of cancel each other.
You are red.
all the big electoral states in the country.
And you drive a truck. And you drive a truck. And you
I'm quad coastal. I drive a hybrid truck.
You go hybrid truck. You got to live for a year in Pennsylvania or something.
I'm a very confusing person.
And this is often why I'm frustrated, because of items like this, Kara, because I forget these tangential connections you have to the topic that I'm talking about. Like, damn, she's from California. You know, forget all the ways in which you're going to find your way to because you're right. You're like, you just knew that, we have cat bag laws.
We have,
they're way more effective than 10%.
Oh, I'll be reminding you, Steve.
Not only do I live in California, I live in LA, and I don't live in West Hollywood, but I spend quite a bit of time in West Hollywood. And West Hollywood, I think, compared to the rest of the country, has the most progressive legislation. It's a tiny little city that is mostly LGBTQI+. Their leadership is as well, and they banned fur. They banned foie gras. They were way early on the plastic bag and the straw and the styrofoam bands. Like,
it's got the Pink Pony Club. That's where all the people are going. No? Anybody?
Sure.
The song?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to keep on dancing.
There you go.
All right. Well, that's a wrap for 2025, guys. Evan, you got to take us out with a quote.
Hey.
Yeah. Well, we're going to tip our hat to an old friend with our quote tonight.
Yes.
Skepticism is an act of doing good in the world. Joe Nickel.
Great guy.
Yep.
Joe Nickel. He
said that on a Point of Inquiry podcast, and it was sweet and short, and we miss you, Joe. We definitely miss you.
Well, guys, it's been a blast doing the show with you in 2025.
Yeah,
that has been survived. We survived.
Island of sanity.
One more year, Bob. That. I'm with you. Yeah. One more year.
One more year.
Bob only ever commits to 1 year at a time.
That's the way to live your life, Bob.
I got
to
re up, man.
Will we have the internet in 1 year? We'll see.
Exactly.
Ian, thanks for joining us.
Of course.
Thanks, buddy.
All you do, Ian.
Thank you so much. And thank you, listeners, to all you do, especially when you go to patreon.com/skepticsguard.
Sorry. Oh, absolutely.
For anyone out there who doesn't know, Ian is our tech guru. He is an absolute magician. I use that term metaphor.
Yeah, sure. I'll take it.
But seriously, I mean, it's amazing what this guy can do. You know, he handles all of our live streaming, all of our live events. It is kind of like we get in front of the camera, like, Ian, work your magic, make it happen.
Yeah.
And we're sitting there like, Ian, come on, it's taking two minutes.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, you just push the button.
I know.
Yeah, just push the button. Push the button.
Don't look behind the curtain. I'm
crying. I thought of this new thing 2 seconds ago. Why isn't it happening?
And also the extravaganza, like the audience will throw weirdest, random, wacky shit, and he'll have an image of it in like 2 minutes.
Not AI, thank you.
Not
I make
AI.
It myself.
That's true.
Thank you
no,
so much.
Yeah.
Does it the old-fashioned way with Photoshop or something?
Yeah, very old-fashioned.
No, Ian, really, you have become indispensable to the SGU. We really appreciate
Thank you very much.
You're never getting that.
Integral, bro.
Oh, wait. Is that a good thing or bad? Oh, no.
Once you're all the way in, you never get out.
You never get
out. All right, guys.
Keep bringing me back in.
Thank you again. Right. Thanks for 2025. Thanks for joining
thanks
me this
Steve.
Week.
Thanks, Steve.
And our until pleasure. Next week and next year, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.